So I preface this by being science and not electronics, but the only way I can see working a magnetic loop in today's propagation is parking your radio on one frequency, running low wattage, and calling CQ and hope that people come back to you, and that's it. Not tuning around and not running even 100 watts, but running, you know, maybe maximum 50 watts, but not moving the dial either. Just hanging out on one frequency is the only way I could see is a poor man's magnetic loop. The only way it would work at all, I would think.
Well, yeah, on the simpler designs, I mean, unfortunately, you know, there's always a retired electrical engineer who wants to see what he can do, and that's sort of the guy who owns a Precision RF. So, yeah, if you don't want the bells and whistles and the least expensive method, then the best approach is to stay on one frequency at a low power rating and see what you can get. And some people do that. They think, especially things like chameleons, are designed to be taken apart and put it in a double bed, carry it to the park and hook it up and get a QRP transceiver and play a QRP, you know, some Sunday.
Someday, maybe in 5 years or so, a magnetic loop will make a lot more sense than it does now, but right now I investigated it, as you know, upward, downward, sideways, and for my budget, which is just about make your own magnetic loop, it's a very daunting proposition to get into it, but it has some kind of sex appeal that people just can't get enough of talking about magnetic loops.
Well, as I mentioned before, it has pluses and it has minuses. People kind of don't think too hard about the minuses, which are severe. Again, narrow bandwidth and low wattage output. But the pluses are very plusy. You don't have to worry about elevation. You don't have to worry about tying into trees. You don't have to worry about all those little fiddly things. It's small. It's disassemblable. It can be hidden in a bag. Much better than a lot of other antenna designs where you got to hide it from your neighbors. This thing, you can just kind of plant it there with a smug smile, and when you finish for the day, disassemble it, put it away, and if anyone has any complaints, you say, what antenna?
I was on a key show today where a guy said that he had a lawn party or a backyard party, and he had constructed a, I think it was a 10-meter loop out of copper fishing wire. Not a loop, I'm sorry, a dipole out of copper fishing wire that nobody mentioned, nobody saw, nobody took notice of. And he said it's so thin that if you're putting up a wire antenna, it may be the way to go. I don't know what the, you know, the lack of diameter is going to do to the signal, but he was all north Florida and Illinois or wherever it worked with this copper fishing line. He said it's so thin that you look up in the sky and you can't even see it if you're right under it.
I think you're alluding to copper clad steel wire. The idea being that the steel core adds a little bit, you can't make it out of copper if it's very thin because copper is ductable. So you make it out of a steel core, very thin, a very, very small diameter steel core, so it's dimensionally stable, and then you clad it in copper, and in effect, the RF only goes on the skin anyway. It has some limitations about power handling capability. You could probably run 25, 50 watts without a problem. You get it past probably 100 watts, you might start to get problems with it. But, yeah, sometimes that's enough. I found just putting my stuff on my roof, no one notices and no one looks up.
He definitely referred to it as fishing lines. The thinnest fishing online you could buy, and so far was pretty happy with it, but these are tough times propagation-wise for those of us who don't have a gallon and a half and 200-foot tower and the rest of the toys. So, anyway, thanks, Roy. Thanks a lot. 73.
You're welcome, Rich. Thanks for participating, and thanks for being there. Let me ask one last time before we give up on Port Charlie. KD2WIW, he checked in earlier tonight, but I guess he was pulled away. If you're back in front of the radio, Charlie, please hit that push to talk button.
WP2AHK.
Yes, AHK, Chester. What can I do you for?
Just about a contact with a fellow who had a magnetic loop. About a week ago, on 20 meters, somewhere around 5:30 in the afternoon, I called CQ. The guy came back to me. There was nobody on the frequency. At that time, it was clear. Conditions obviously must have been very good. Make a long story short, guy had a magnetic loop, commercial one, and he was a QRP man, running 5 watts with his magnetic loop. And I was talking, I had a conversation with him for over 30, 35 minutes, maybe 40 minutes. So bear in mind, once again, there was no QR Mary. And he was not coming in 20 over 9. Noise floor was about S2, S3. He was coming in S4, S5 with his magnetic loop. 5 watts, we had a great conversation. It all has to do with, conditions and QR Mary. And 5 watts across the pond. So I had a good conversation with a guy, and he enjoyed running 5 watts, and he could have run more power. He has different rigs and different antennas, but he was just having fun with his magnetic loop, and he had a great conversation. That's all I wanted to say. WB2AHK.
Okay, very good, Chester. Yeah, I mean, if propagation conditions are right, I think I repeatedly tell the story of a guy who took a 100-watt light bulb, put it on a wood fence post, and when he was done, he got a workable state certificate out of it, just using that as his radiator. So, like I mentioned before, there are negative aspects to magnetic loops, nothing's perfect. But, yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. Propagations are right. A magnetic loop can do magical things.
Okay, Roy, very good. I just wanted to mention that. 73, WB2AHK. You doing great work. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Chester. 73 to you as well. Once again, this is ACGS. We're coming real close to the SpaceNet report, and I mentioned some riddles, some puzzlers. Let me try one and see if anyone is interested in playing tonight. Okay, here's one. A sundial has the fewest number of moving parts of any timepiece. Anyone want to hazard a guess what kind of device has the most moving parts for a given timepiece? Yes, Bob.
I'm just going to guess a standard wind-up watch.
Okay, Bob, that's a good suggestion, but I have something in my mind that has a lot more moving parts. So I'll throw it out to everyone out there. And Bob, if you want to give a second try, that's okay as well.
I'm guessing one of those watches that shows the date and the time and the phases of the moon and a stopwatch and multiple time zones and all sorts of fancy stuff. WB2KW6.
Hello, Ken. Yeah, those are called complications, and usually They do introduce a lot more parts because they serve more non-time related purposes, complications. There's also a weird device called a Turbulum, which was designed for pocket watches. The concept being that the position of your pocket watch was always the same, so gravity works in an unequal manner on the way that you walked around with your pocket watch. So this was something that kind of was rigged up to kind of rotate in complete space and do away with the orientation of your pocket watch. It's meaningless for a wristwatch, because if you think about your wristwatch, it's a different orientation throughout the day. And it adds something like $20,000 to the cost of a watch, which is now, for some strange reason, a plus. But that's a very good guess, Cat, a multi-complication watch, but I can still comp you on something that has a lot more moving parts.
A timepiece powered by a pendulum?
Well, not necessarily. It does introduce the pendulum instead of a spring. You might have a few more parts to it because of the substitution, or it might be about the same. Probably there's more bits and pieces in a multi-complicated wristwatch than a pendulum-based watch.
And to HOH?
Yes, Andy.
Are the moving parts basically, in for the most part, all the same?
Okay, I think you figured it out. I could be obtuse and obscure, but I won't. Yes, they could be the same.
Okay, so should I just stand down, because I guess I said enough so that you know I know what it is. Maybe somebody else would like to guess.
Okay, Andy, N2HUH gave you a really good hit. So anyone else want to suggest what the answer might be? Well, I guess not. Andy, do you want to, give the answer to everyone?
Yes. I almost forgot what it's called, though. It's the sands of time, the hourglass. But I guess you can use grains of sugar, salt, or whatever else you want to use. But an hourglass.
Yes, indeed. It's an hourglass. Every little grain of sand in the sanded hourglass is going to be a lot more parts than any other watch that I could think of. You could put all kinds of interesting things. Occasionally, I see that they put little grains of iron, and they give you a free magnet, so you can play magnet with it. But you know, sand is my preference. I actually got a hourglass that was set for about 3 minutes so that I could use it for the timeout as a signal in my head to when I have to release that push to talk. It never quite works, but you can't really reset an hourglass.
Yes, well, as I'm cleaning up the shack here, you really had my head spinning on that one. But I came across this many years ago when I was thinking about it, and I did remember how I used one of those egg timers. But I did actually, in Brooklyn, I did have an hourglass, and I did lose that, but I did remember. Wouldn't want to guess how many grains of sand was in that unit. But very good work. Thanks for joining.
Thanks. I'm fascinated by hourglasses. I have a few that are optimized for a couple of minutes. I have others that are much bigger in the living room, usually with a nautical sensibility. It's made out of brass and glass and fine white sand. So I'm sort of fascinated. It's not the most accurate timekeeper in the world, as you can imagine, but it's fun to play.
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, you're talking about magnetic loops. It's actually a sore point, a sour point with me, because I came close to obtaining a, which I can't be sure if it was a homemade or some type of commercial made unit. I just missed getting my hands on it. I did get my hands on something else instead. I had a chance to take it, but it was a little on the heavy side, and it was on a roof, but I do believe that was a unit for tuning variable air capacitors, air capacitors for the magnetic loops. Actually, I have three pieces. I have one variable air capacitor that has a gear on it, and I guess you can kind of change them depending on the band or what part of the band you want. And then I have a couple that were actually manually adjustable to get in the right range. So I guess there was a couple of sockets for putting in both the one or two manual air capacitors and one that was motorized to adjust. And I wouldn't have been able to get the control unit for it, but I would have had the main unit. I just missed out on that. Very disappointed.
Yeah. No, well, what can I tell you? The one that got away, we remember those much more than the ones that we get. It's a fascinating thing. And nowadays, microcontrollers, servo technology is going down in price. The only incredible expensive cost are those damn compute capacitors. Either they have to be enormous, which is expensive, or they have to be vacuum capacitors, which are expensive. So I don't foresee a technological advancement that's going to drop the price as far as current wattage carrying capacity. I think the tuning mechanism will be much nicer as time goes on, but they're going to still be subject to the low power output.
Yeah, and I think the, if I remember correctly, the ones that I have, the range, when I connected them up to my capacitor analyzer, the range on it wasn't that much. It wasn't as wide as you would like or used to be, but it was variable, so you could navigate a bit there. You still use your magnetic loop, or how's that still up, or still up going?
No, it wasn't a transmission magnetic loop. It was purely a reception magnetic loop. So I sort of used it initially before I could get antennas up. And once I got antennas up, it was a kind of a backup. And then one day it failed, and I assumed that the rain went into it or someplace. Later on, I realized that what had happened was something, a squirrel or a cat, had basically chewed right through the cable that ran everything, so it was dead. I've retired it to my garage for the time being, and thankfully the antennas on my roof do a better job than it tends to.
Okay, Roy, very good. Roger on that. And back to you. This is Andy at the end to retweet.
Okay, very good. Thank you for playing our game, Andy. Thanks to everyone else for playing our game. I have a few more puzzles, but I'll save them for next Sunday night. Now it's 10:23. It's more than time for full WS2N and its spaceman report. So please, Paul, take it away.
Oh, okay. AC2GS, WS2N. Very good. On the air. The hourglass. I remember the 3-minute hourglass. My mother used to make the 3-minute egg. You flip the 3-minute timer hourglass over, and when it was empty, it was done. But okay, we had a couple of spacewalks last week. We had two hams go outside early in the week, and then the same two hams went outside the International Space Station today, this morning. Shane Kimbrough, KE5HOD, with Tomas Biscuit from the European Space Agency, KG5FYG, but of course he's got an American call sign because when they study in the States, when they train in the States as astronauts, they, one of the things they do is a lot of them try to get their ham license. That's where they can work in schools or anybody from the space station when they do finally make it up there. So, the goal was to increase the amount of power on the space station. It's going to take, a year or two to complete, depending on when they can, get the next flight up there with more of these solar panels. Over the last couple of years, they've changed out all the batteries, all nickel hydrogen batteries, and they changed them over to lithium. They're getting the same amount of power out of those batteries, but with half the amount of weight and half the amount of batteries. They used to have 48, now they have 24 lithium ion batteries. They were made in Japan and sent up on the HTV cargo vehicles from Japan launched on Japanese rockets. But that is upgrading the solar panel. There's going to be half a dozen of these things that are going to be done over the next year or two, I guess. They started a few months ago. They installed all the struts that are going to be holding the new solar panels in place. And they're called IROS, or International Space Station Rollout Solar Arrays. So they're different than the existing solar panels that are on the station. Ones on the station unfold like an accordion. These literally roll out. These tubes that, pretty large tubes made of a carbon type of material that is rolled up. Like if you were to roll up your hose in your garden hose, you roll that up a couple of turns and then release it, it would unroll itself. And that's the kind of the design that this is. Except the only difference is it's about 65 feet long. So, they're rolled up under pressure. And when they're finally installed and they release the bolts on there, they immediately start to unfurl, and there's a braking mechanism, like a drag brake, so it doesn't snap out, it goes out slowly, it takes about 10 minutes. And the first spacewalk they did early in the week, their goal was to take the solar arrays, and when they're packed, they're about 2 feet in diameter, and roughly about 5 feet long. And those 5 feet sections eventually turn into 1/10 foot section, and then the whole thing rolls out. The robotic arm initially took these things out of the dragon, the trunk of the dragon. Dragon had gone up a while back. For mission control in Houston. The IROS panels out of the trunk and install them on a temporary setup on the truss of the International Space Station. The truss runs around 300 feet, I think it's 357 feet long. So they installed it temporarily there with a robotic arm. And then now the spacewalk has come out and they, to some extent, hand over hand, they did use the robotic arm to reach as far as they could on the space station. And it rides on a track on the space station. They go so far, but they have to go all the way to the end. They call it the P6 structure section, all the way at the very end. So to do that, they actually hand it off to one another as they go down the truss to to the final location. And then they started installing it, and they got so far, as they were doing this, Shane Kimbrough had a little problem with spacesuits, lost the display, couldn't read the display, of what his spacesuit was doing. So that killed about an hour. He had to go back to the Quest lab. That's the lab where you exit and enter the space station. And his partner stayed out on the truck, waited for to see if they could do something about the display panel. And they did. He got inside the Quest and NASA helped him out. Sure enough, the panel came back to life, and he went out and joined Thomas McKay back at the work site. But by that time, they started running out of time, and they got as far as bolting the iROSAs up to the truss sections that were holding us, that were put in the spacewalk to go. And they didn't get a chance to unroll it. So they went out again today on Father's Day, early this morning, to NASA figured out a solution on what the problem was. They had problems with the bolts that connect the iROSAs together. They figured out a cure on what to do. I think essentially they used a type of pin wrench or to realign the holes to get it where they needed, and they started driving it. Around four big bolts into the part of the ISS to attach these things. After that, they were able to release the rolled up solar array. Release these different clamps that they had on it. Sure enough, that went well. And there was a picture now. I just saw it. It's too late for me to put it on Roy's website, but it's a picture of the two astronauts spacewalking out there with the rolled out solar array, completely extended. It's bolted, where the base of the old solar array is, and then it comes out at about 10 degrees off the existing solar arrays. About half the size, but they put out twice the amount of power, time marched on. So these are much more efficient than the old solar arrays. Each one puts out around 20 kilowatts, the new ones. By the time they're done, I think they would be up to around 120 extra kilowatts. It does shade part of the existing solar arrays, but they're starting to deteriorate anyway. So they figured out that they're probably down to around 160 now at their peak. And after doing all this, they'll be up to around 215 kilowatts available to the space station. Doing that, now of course they got an extra 20, but they're going to be doing a lot more of these installs, and by that time they'll be up to that number. So probably about 8 more spacewalks involved, 6 or 8 more to do this work over the next year or so. So we'll follow it along. The space station right now, they're planning on 2028. I guess they're going to go beyond that to 2030. The space station is in very good shape. And let's move on to a different topic, unless somebody has any questions about the EVA. Okay, we have another topic I'm going to cover from last week. It kind of like ran out of time. Got a little too late. The spacecraft Juno is in orbit around Jupiter. It's in a polar orbit, and it's been doing that for quite a few years now. I remember it passed Earth around 2013 on the way to Jupiter. They did a test. They had ham radio operators to see if they could transmit a slow CW. And then they had this plasma instrument on board the spacecraft, and they wanted to see if it would receive the signal. They like 1,000 amps to a couple thousand amps to a transmit flow, CW, and I mean very slow. You would hold a dot now for a real long time and a dash for a really long time. And they showed you on the internet how long, you went by the internet on how to do this. That was really very interesting. Anyway, I got involved with that, and sure enough, anybody that participated wound up with a card. It's like a QSL card, but a card from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at NASA doing that. By the way, in plasma, it did copy the word. It was, we were sending out the word HI, HI, did. So we didn't have to do any dashes. But that was a lot of fun. Anyway, the spacecraft has been in orbit. Originally, they planned on bringing the amount of orbits, total orbits that it would do for the whole mission. They wanted to do, 14 orbits, 33 orbits, 14 days for every orbit. They had problems with the propulsion unit. They didn't want to refire it. They thought maybe something would explode with their main thruster, their main rocket, when they were in orbit around Jupiter. So they said, well, we'll leave it at a 53-day orbit. Every 53 days we'll go around, and we'll just do the same amount of science. It'll just take longer. Years ago, and it's still functioning well. Juno's doing great. It's a big spacecraft. I mean, it's got solar panels on it that, collectively, from one end to the other, would be 120 feet, 60 feet out from the center. So you have three big solar panels. And the reason they have that is because they're not using nuclear power to power this thing. In the last time we were in orbit around Jupiter, we used a Galileo spacecraft, and that used the nuclear system, where this has just big solar panels, modern technology, higher output from the solar panels. They're able to make them stronger to withstand the acceleration. When they went around that planet, which was around a little over 100,000 miles an hour, 120,000 miles an hour, when it started going into orbit around Jupiter. So, to withstand the acceleration, you have to have pretty strong solar panels, and they held up fine. So, now, as the years are going by, you saw a lot of studying of the gas of Jupiter and, everything about Jupiter itself, but now they're devoting more science time to the planets, moon going around Jupiter.
WB2HRO with
special. Close to Ganymede. Ganymede's a very big moon, so big it's bigger than the planet Mercury, but it's a big moon, has its own magnetic field, and we studied it before with Voyager, it's gone past there, Pioneer spacecraft, it's gone past years ago. But and then, of course, Galileo, which was in orbit for years, six years before they deorbited the spacecraft, parked it up in the atmosphere. This one came within 600 miles of the surface. Very good pictures. It was taken, and it's got all kinds of instruments, like I said before, plasma instruments, magnetometers, and all kinds of data was sent back to Earth. And scientists will probably be looking at that data for years. In the future, they're going to pass other planets, other moons around that Jupiter with the same spacecraft.
I have a question, WB2HRO.
Continued operation of this thing. Doing very well. Any questions?
Yes, WB2HRO. I would assume that they're using nuclear power for the spacecraft. That's the
too good if it came down. You know what I mean? But if it doesn't explode, it would use radioactive material all over the place. Over.
On Juno, it's solar panels, big, like I said, around total around probably 180 feet of solar panels. Around 180 feet of solar panels. So they were able to get a lot of kilowatts out of that. They chose that because in the past they used the Galileo spacecraft, which was nuclear powered, and they had. You know, it has a radioisotope thermoelectric generator on Galileo. A radioisotope, meaning it's got plutonium-239 and it's 238 inside the spacecraft, and then surrounding that, they have this graphite blankets, and inside the graphite blankets, tend to trap the heat. And inside the graphite blankets, they have these thermocouples, and it's hundreds and hundreds of thermocouples. Some are in series, some are parallel, and that's how they get their voltage out of that nuclear pile, and then in turn goes back and charges batteries, and that's how they do that on many, many spacecraft. They've probably done it on, you know, at least 30 spacecraft over the last, I don't know how many decades. But, when Galileo was conceived, solar panels weren't that strong to withstand the amount of power that you got out of the solar panels was not sufficient back then. But, you know, this thing here, was only launched, maybe 8 years ago. And, time marched on. Its panels are strong. The amount of power that you can get out of the solar panels is wide, so they went with that. And also, there's shortages tend to be a shortage of the active uranium that they use, plutonium that they use.
Yeah, and if there's an accident to the plutonium in the United States that's scattered around, I guess they're not worried about it if it crashes into the computer or whatever, but if it comes down to Earth, like, you could have a serious problem, even when it's on a lung. Over.
UT on the subject. Back to you.
Whiskey Bravo 2, Hotel Radio Oxygen, call him.
HRO, okay. Hotel Radio Oxygen. That's a good stuff. HRO. And Radio Alpha. Back to you.
I was here before them. 58 years of call. My call. Over.
Oh, they stole it from you. That's terrible. Very good. Okay, does that answer your question to some degree? Back to you.
I didn't hear you. Did I ask you about the risk of sending the nuclear stuff in space? You can answer my question. Over.
The risk? You're talking about launch? When you launch from Earth, the risk of, the thing blowing up and contaminating Earth, is that it?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of rocks go up and don't quite make it, slam back down onto the Earth or something goes wrong, over.
Oh, I'm sorry, I got it. I thought you were asking about the pros and cons for actually going to Jupiter with or without solar panels compared to the RTGs. Back when Cassini launched, Cassini was another one that orbited Saturn, and it did that for 14 years, and it was launched again with an RTG, and there was a lot of protests back then. I remember that. You probably did too. There was a lot of protests. Artists think they'd come back and hit the Earth and contaminate everybody. Even one micro you know, simple as micro atom of the of this, you know, quartz can. But it did launch anyway, and because what NASA proved, and I saw the test, they used to take these canisters that it was contained in, and they used to blow them up. I mean, they'd take them out to the field, you know, not with the uranium in them, but the canisters themselves, and literally blow them up, you know, many, many times to see if they could, you know, damage these things. Then they even took one in a plane and crashed it to the ground. The results, and they couldn't get these things to leak at all. And you know, that was decades ago, you know, to prove that these things were safe. So that's why they do launch them. The last one we launched was New Horizon, that went out to Pluto and beyond. Now it's still operating. The Voyagers, of course, they were all RTGs. They're still operating. Pioneers, they're on a course outside of the solar system. They launched before Voyagers, and no problem. Of course, they're not functioning anymore. Vacuum, HRO, like that. WS-1.
Okay, so they made it so it's actually crashed. It leaves the nuclear part of it.
That's good.
But anyway, very good. I just have to talk to you during the name of the show.
How was your being Juliet?
Reginald, go ahead, please.
Okay, thanks, Joe. And very good. EAB, go ahead.
Yeah, a radioisotope prevention generator would never, ever, ever be used in Earth orbit. You do not need them at all until you're getting far enough from the sun that solar panels are more of a problem than their work. The New Horizons that went out to and beyond Pluto, solar panels were absolutely useless that far from the sun. That's where they use them. When something is going that far away from the sun, that solar panels aren't going to work. That's the only alternative option. And no, they never, ever, ever come back.
Very good, Ed. Yeah, what goes up doesn't necessarily come back down. Yeah, and we have quite a few of them. Like I said before, the two pioneers, they're not coming back. The Voyagers, they're not coming back. We had another one, Ulysses, in solar orbit, polar solar orbit. When I talk about solar orbit, they went out. It's an orbit around. They went as far as Jupiter, and they went, you know, north around the sun that way. So that will never come back to Earth. So I mean, if you want to, you know, we have big, you know, that's in a solar orbit, but. Then we have a couple of them on Mars waiting for us when we get there. You know, you have plutonium on the Curiosity rover. Now the Perseverance rover. That's kind of like waiting for us when we get there, right? You know. You know, somebody will go over there, you know, after space travel is really common, and somebody might be trying to crack this thing open. Pathfinder with Sojourner had one on it. Not to run the electricity, but just to keep the electronics warm when we drop it. No, I had one on it. But,
There's also a shortage of these things.
If they had an infinite supply, they would just put them on, long duration missions, long missions that are not coming back. And they sure enough would not use them in orbit. They sent one to the moon, a couple to the moon, to run the some of the equipment that the astronauts left behind. They did have a RTG on that. So I guess they were probably worried that maybe, if Apollo did go up and came back down and crashed, you might contaminate the Atlantic Ocean or something. Any other comments? Back to you, Ed.
No, that's fine, Paul. It's just one thing. Also, keep in mind, these things are just basically a hunk of metal that stays fairly hot on its own. They don't get that hot, and they only last for about 20, 30 years. In 100 years, they're probably dead cold.
The heat output is down. The electrical output from it is 4% a year on Voyager. That's why I have to keep shutting things down. It's down to a couple of instruments that'll work. No more cameras or anything like that. But they do put out a lot of heat. They run the heat tubing from, let's say, Voyager. They actually pick up the heat and run these small pipes different locations on the spacecraft to keep different parts of the spacecraft warm. And they do that on all these missions. So it has a two-fold process, including like Perseverance on riding around on Mars. It has two purposes. It keeps the battery charged. They have two 44 amp hour batteries on Perseverance. And they keep those charged. And by doing it, they're running 109 watts of electricity on Perseverance. That's what they get all day long. So if you have, let's say, 10 hours of daylight, you got enough to light a 100 light bulb for 1 hour. So that's what Perseverance is doing. And yet they take the heat from that, and they keep all the electronics warm on that spacecraft. Let these temperatures drop down to minus 120 degrees every night. You start having problems, so it keeps everything nice and toasty. The solar panel ones do the same thing, but it takes a lot of energy to actually have a little heat inside these different spacecraft to keep the electronics warm. But with the RTGs, you can actually take the heat that's being given off. I think it's over 1,000 watts per hour that you can get from, temperature-wise, the equivalent of whatever that is, from the RTGs. Any other comments?
Yes. Doesn't it better for electronics to work cold? Because I know years ago they used to have cooling.
Yeah, cold, but not, just like the deep space probes that are going down to minus 300 degrees. No, that's not good for the electronics. The electronics want to be in a Goldilocks zone, they work better cool. So when they start heating up with they use an RTGs, or if they use an electric heat is from, if you're on a solar panel rover, like Spirit or Opportunity, they have thermostat phase. They know if it's getting too hot, and they'll shut it down. So they can control it, and they do control it, so it don't get too hot, and it's too cold back here.
Also, gearbox. Really, really cold.
I forgot about that. Yeah, they have the grease they use
can go into these very low temperatures for the wheels, which don't really get the kind of heat that you need. So, you know, I mean, your motors turning the wheels. You get six wheels on a thing. So, you know, you have to. They have these, you know, wonderful degrees, but you know, anywhere, you know, close to the body of this thing, they have heat, you know, coming out of the RTGs that are actually literally being piped to wherever they need it. But yeah, you know, gears are not happy with super cold temperatures. And the change in temperature, you know, in the day you can go up to, you know, you might get up to 30 degrees or 40 degrees, you know, where Perseverance is right now. Any comments before I move on? WS2N. I think I talked to you, Ed, about this telescope. They call it the NEO type of telescope, the Near Earth telescope. It's going to be called the Near Earth Object Survey. That's been approved. Talking last week and the week before about telescope that would be have a lot of Earth-based telescopes and that kind of work. But you know, you need something dedicated to doing that in space. And I talked about Rusty Schweikert, an astronaut that was on Apollo 9. He was retired. He took up the torch to try to get people to invest, or corporations or somebody in NASA to invest in what he called the Sentinel telescope. He wanted to put one out near Venus, looking out toward the asteroid belt and trying to earmark every possible asteroid that was out there. This way, you know, we know where they are and if something's going to come by anytime in the future. But he couldn't get funded for that. He tried. But sure enough, the other day, I guess last week, NASA got an approval for the Near Earth Object Surveyor telescope. Also going to work on IR, which is infrared. They both have the same idea. If you look at something that's small and dark, you're not going to see it optically, but you will see it within infrared. So, you know, this is going to be located at the L1. L1 is Lagrange Point 1. You know, there's five Lagrange points. L1 is roughly a million miles away from Earth, going in the direction of the sun. So not quite where Rusty Schweikert wanted. He wanted to put one at the Venus orbit, you know, really close in. Over 30 million miles away from us. This is only going to be about a million miles away from us. And it has the capability of actually looking both directions, looking for infrared signatures flying through space. So, they have an approval for it. It's around 25 feet long, probably about 4,000 pound satellite. And they think it'll probably launch either on a Dragon or maybe an Atlas V. And it looks like around 2026, before, you know, when it gets into orbit. So, I think that's something. And they've talked about this thing before, and they finally got an approval. It's got on one side, it's got solar panels with a combination of carbon type of insulator to try to keep it, you know, cool from the sun. Infrared telescope looking out, and they said it's 20 centimeters in diameter. What's that, like eight inches in diameter telescope? So that should be good. We'll have an idea if something's coming our way somewhere down the road. Right now they mapped out, I think, I don't know, 10% or something of the big asteroids over 400 feet in diameter. They want to go down to 100 feet they think like, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not a million of these things that are out there that could possibly come our way. You get hit with something from 400 feet diameter, you'll have like
a Russia situation
with back in, I think, 2013, where this thing floated up in the air and was brighter than the sun. And didn't kill anybody, but it injured like 1,000 people. It destroyed a lot of buildings, not destroyed, but, you know, a lot of blast damage buildings in that town. So, they didn't see that one coming. Any comments? WS2N.
WB2EAB, go ahead.
Yeah, talking about objects out there that we want to make sure we're aware of, if they're going to hit us, maybe stop them. Do you have any idea the size of whatever it was that caused the meteor crater in Winslow, Arizona?
Probably heard that 3 or 4 times on documentaries. I want to say it was 30 feet, but I guess not big. But I can't, you know, I'm sure I can find it real quick on the net. Put in Arizona crater, that's the name of it. Wikipedia, and they'll tell you how big that thing was, the estimated size. Isn't that thing like a mile in diameter or something?
Exactly. Just about a mile in diameter crater. And just think about what would happen if that. Now, I think they said it about 25,000 years ago. But I'm just saying, an event like that today, hitting the city, beyond everything.
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's why they are working on different ways to move asteroids around. They have this DART mission coming up next year to go out to this asteroid which has a moon going around. And we talked about that last week, just to see if they could actually change the speed of the this whole system, this dual system that's moving along. You know, it's not coming near Earth, but you know, they want to be able to see if they can do it. So they'll hit it with a 1,000-pound projectile at 18,000 miles an hour or something like that. And then they'll take accurate measurements and compute sets that was going to be out there looking at it when they do it. And then ESA, European Space Agency, is going to launch another spacecraft. I think it's called HEPA, or HERA, H-E-R-A. And that's going to go out to the same ones to actually look at the damage, investigated more. So a lot of these missions are, you know, we get involved with the European Space Agency or Russia or somebody, not China, but all these other countries, which is good. Brazil just signed on with us too for the Artemis program. Plan on contributing, and then, you know, we can share science out of these moon missions that we're planning. I forget how many different countries have now signed up for that. But that's good. Any other comments? Getting late, but I definitely want to talk about Hubble for a minute. The K2RIW was a big Hubble hugger, as they call it. And, Hubble is now having some computer problems. Fortunately, one computer that is having a problem on board is the one that makes all the arrangements. You know, in that telescope says, "Okay, we're going to point here, we're going to point there. How long we're going to point there, and that type of thing." Well, that one has failed. Call it a payload. I think it's called a payload, a computer. And then they tried to reboot it, went through the process, to see if it would come back to life, and it didn't. One thing NASA's good about is redundancy, so they do have a backup computer that they're switching to. I haven't heard yet if that has worked, but my guess probably has, because that was a couple of